Now, In Depth with Francis Rose.
Thanks for listening on Friday, July 31st, 2015. It's the Federal News Countdown, the three most important federal news stories of the week, and two experts in the world of the federal government choose them every week. This week, it's John Kamensky, the IBM Center for the Business of Government. It's great to see you, my friend. Thanks for coming in today.
Thank you for the invite.
And happy to do it. And Alan Shvatkin is Executive Vice President and Counsel at the Professional Services Council. And it's good to see you as always, Alan. Thanks
always
for coming in.
Always a pleasure, Francis.
You each have chosen great stories as this week's three most important federal news stories of the week. We'll start the Federal News Countdown with... Alan, let's go with you first, and your choice is Jason's Jason Miller story on federalnewsradio.com. OMB tells agencies to take electronic invoicing out of the Stone Age. This is one of the stories, when they pop up every once in a while, people who are outside of the government read this and just go, oh my gosh, it confirms, unfortunately, sadly, some of the stereotypes that people outside government have of the federal government, don't you think?
Absolutely. The three things caught my attention in this. First of all, the use of the word Stone Age in the header, that's interesting. Secondly, that Jason was up early enough to publish this at 10 o'clock in the morning, that's also surprising. But third, that the federal government is only using about 40% of their invoices going electronically. I went back and looked at the federal government mandated the use of electronic funds transfers in 1978.
Whoops.
1978. I found a letter that I wrote to the government in support of the use of the Defense Department's wide area workflow in 1997, endorsing the whole process. And so here we are, you know, literally decades later, and we're only at a 40% take-up rate. Mm-hmm. So I welcome this memo. I wish we had seen it earlier. I wish that the memo had been out earlier, and I hope that it won't take us 3 years to get to 100% or close to 100% of use of electronic funds transfers.
Jason writes, Treasury launched the internet payment platform in 2008. OMB worked with them to improve the platform and figure how to offer it government-wide. I think that's a good sign, is that this didn't develop in such a way that every agency said, all right, terrific, we'll figure out our platform, you know, and then we wind up with 25 or 30 of these things.
Absolutely, and as Dave Bader has said time and time again, these are the exact ideas that make sense for shared services. They make sense for government-wide process. These are administrative processes, and we've seen in the Defense Department and Homeland Security and other agencies that use electronic funds, that use the electronic invoicing, speed goes up, error rates go down, prompt payment where the government owes companies if they don't pay on time go down into the decimal point, you know, the single digits after the decimal point in terms of exposure.
They don't have an official shared services provider. You have to explain to OMB why you're not going to use Treasury and tell them where you're going to go if you're not going to use Treasury. So that's not exactly a stick approach, not a carrot either. But do you think at some point we would see, if we get close to this three-year deadline and some folks are still straggling, do you think we might see, if the next administration cares that much about shared services, somebody say, okay, it has to happen now?
I would hope so. We're at the stage now where we're processing so many millions, almost 20 million transactions a year. It makes no sense to handle the bulk of those in paper. I mean, just John Gilroy's session just before ours on Fed Tech Talk talked about electronic use of documents and everything else like that. The world is going that way. Mm-hmm. The world is going that way.
Alan Shvatkin's choice as the third most important federal news story of the week is from federalnewsradio.com. It is headlined, OMB tells agencies to take electronic invoicing out of the Stone Age. John Kamensky, your choice at number three is not quite a news story yet, although it will be on Monday.
I hope so.
I promise you that it will be. You wrote me a note. You said, is it okay if I put this on there, because I'm very specific in asking people to submit news stories, and I let this one slide. I don't do that very often, but you sent me this link to a GAO report titled Managing for Results, Practices for Effective Agency Strategic Reviews. Chris Mim of GAO headed up this report, and Chris is going to be on the program on Monday talking about this, so that's why I let this one slide.
Okay.
What did you see here, though, that's really important to you?
Well, what I thought was interesting is that this is a good news story, and the thing that happens is the Government Performance and Results Act was passed initially in 1993, and it's been very slow in the implementation. But it requires OMB to annually determine whether agencies have met their performance goals, and if they haven't, explain why and what they're going to do about that. And OMB created a process, it's called the strategic review process, where they asked every agency to do a strategic review at least once a year on their strategic objectives, and that's about 350 of them across the government. And last year, in 2014, they conducted their first set of reviews. And the GAO report looks at six agencies and identified what are some of the best practices that, that these agencies have developed in hopes that other agencies will see sort of what's going on and adopt these practices in the future. And what's also, I thought, noteworthy is that in 2015, OMB had a cross-agency working group that developed their own best practices and began implementing it for the 2015 reviews, which are just beginning to wind up now.
Mm-hmm.
And what they've done, and it sort of adopts some of the things that GAO has highlighted, is that instead of doing dozens of reviews, is to begin doing some of those at a lower level. And then at the deputy secretary and the deputy director for management of OMB is that for each agency, they would have sort of the super review. They're calling it FedStat. And it's not only looking at agency strategic objectives, but also the IT portfolio stat and these other mission support areas, HR stat. And they're finding by looking at it holistically or enterprise-wide that they're able to address some issues strategically that they've never been able to address before. So there's a lot of hope that comes across from the GAO report and what's going on actually in the agencies.
I appreciate what you said about this being a good news story, because just the methodology that they lay out in the highlights page of this, GAO identified seven practices federal agencies can employ from the strategic review processes conducted at the Departments of Agriculture, Education, Homeland Security, and Housing and Urban Development, Environmental Protection Agency, and NASA. And as you read down through, first of all, there's only seven. It's not like there's 38,000 of these things that you have to go through. There's seven of them. And they cite examples from each of these agencies who are already doing these things. They didn't have to choose bad things that happen to say don't do that. They're able to cite all of this stuff throughout this entire report where agencies are doing these things well, and GAO is suggesting just do what they're doing.
Yeah, yeah. And for example, in the Department of Agriculture's Food and Nutrition Service, they developed a model that showed how the output of the programs, of the food and nutrition programs like SNAP and School Lunch and WIC, how do they tie back to the department's overall objective to increase nutritious food access to nutritious food? So they're beginning to take this and look at this much more strategically and across agency or bureau or program boundaries.
Chris is going to be on the program at 5 o'clock on Monday afternoon. So your desired news story should come shortly
after
that, my friend. John Kaminsky's choice is the third most important federal news story of the week is actually from the Government Accountability Office, Managing for Results, Practices for Effective Agency Strategic Reviews. And you can find that work and you can hear Chris Monday afternoon at federalnewsradio.com. When we come back on the Federal News Countdown, the second most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by John Kaminsky and Alan Shvatkin, it's the Federal News Countdown. This is the Federal News Countdown on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. The three most important federal news stories of the week is selected by John Kaminsky and Alan Shvatkin, and we're at
number two.
Alan, your choice for the second most important federal news story of the week is from Emily Kopp on federalnewsradio.com. GSA delays contract for services to protect OPM hack victims. I saw your boss's message about this, and he's quoted in this story. He's not happy, and for once, I agree with him. That's not. I'm kidding about that. But I can understand why he and everybody else is not happy about this, and I can't find anybody that's not happy about this.
Well, I think Emily's done some great reporting here, and she posted this at a reasonable hour to read, so that was good, too. But that's exactly right, that this is an area where the treatment of federal employees was absolutely right. Within literally days, hours of the identification of the first breach, they were provided with immediate notifications and protections. Now we've got 21.5 million people who are potentially at risk under the second breach that occurred, and 5 weeks later, we're still waiting for that information. So OPM, to its credit, is trying to get that solicitation out, but they had to delay it, cancel the old one, restart it. We're still trying to dig with them a little bit more to find out what was the why they had to do that. I've got some thoughts and some little information, but I don't have enough facts to go on yet. But we're still waiting, and it's going to be mid-August at the earliest before they can get that information out. And I just think that the 21 million people who are anxious to know what the impact is on them, how they're affected, and what we can do about it, does the government provide protection or not, need an answer.
Mm-hmm. The problem here is, as we talk about these things on many occasions, John, is a lack of clarity. We're not sure to this day why OPM selected Windvale and CSID. There was already, Jason reported a couple of weeks ago, identity protection services available on a GSA schedule that they could have just gotten immediately instead of getting them from this company that nobody really knew was in this business before. And we don't know what the delay really is in trying to get this out the door now. And I think it's probably that uncertainty that's got people in such an uproar. Do you think that's a fair observation?
You know, if OPM was criticized for the first contract, they're going to be careful about the second one. And in the second one is so much bigger.
Mm-hmm.
It's five times bigger.
Yeah. But that, and I understand all of this. I understand the sensitivity about wanting to make sure you get it done right the first time. You don't want to mess it up, especially with all the spotlight that's on the agency. But it's that uncertainty that I think is really the biggest problem.
Right, and now, all we've proposed is take an interim step. Start the notifications as quickly as you can. Maybe you don't know all 21.5 million people who are affected, but you know 5 million, 10 million, 12 million. Start somewhere. Begin that notification process. Secondly, begin the coverage. Offer the same thing that to the affected individuals in the second breach as the federal employees got, 18 months. And then if that's going to change, if there's going to be longer coverage, 10 years, 5 years, lifetime, that's going to take some time to work out. We shouldn't wait for the perfect solution to provide any coverage and any notifications, and that's what our concern is.
Did you have any experience, good or bad, with the notification from the first breach, John?
I got notified, and within minutes had signed up on the website. It was smooth. It was simple. I have had a good experience.
See, that's my fear, too, is that if you're OPM, no matter what happens with the second batch, they're going to get criticized. I heard a number of, obviously, we heard the complaints. I heard many folks, though, that had the same experience that you had, John, that were able to do it fairly seamlessly.
But I knew better than to try to call.
Well, but to be fair to the folks who tried to call and couldn't get through, they shouldn't have offered the service if they didn't expect, hey, there's 4 million people that could possibly call. We have to at least be ready to ramp to some degree of that they weren't ready for.
There was going to be hiccups along the way. There always is. You can scale, but you don't scale for everybody calling on the same day and the first day. Yeah. So there was some issues that some of that could have been addressed by the government. Some of it could have been addressed by the contractor. Not here to talk about that, except that it is instructive on how to get ready for the second one. But they can move more expeditiously on something rather than on nothing, and that's where that concern is. There are other implications to from the breach. As you know, OPM also shut down the front door, the EQIP system, which is the application process for new security clearances. That was down for about 3 weeks. And so the backlog of applications for new clearances also was stuck. They've now slightly opened that door for those who had been cut off in the processing, but they haven't opened that for all others as well. And so here again, we've been raising some concerns with OPM and the Office of Management and Budget because it's having a direct impact now on contract performance.
The EQIP reopening, I thought, was interesting because when they first announced it was 4 to 6 weeks. And as you accurately noted, they reopened within 3 weeks. And so I wonder if that was just the way it happened to work out, which is entirely possible, or if this was a case of under-promise and over-deliver, a lesson learned from the breach in the first place and then the response to the first breach in the second place.
Yeah.
I don't know what the case is there. It will be interesting to see as that plays out. Alan Shvodkin's choice is the second most important federal news story of the week. GSA delays contract for services to protect OPM hack victims. John Kaminsky, your choice number two is Charlie Clark's story in GovExec. Bipartisan evidence-based policy bill passes the House. I have to confess, I saw this story and thought of you when it broke because I knew this would be right up your alley, anticipating you might be on the program.
Well, thank you very much.
I knew this would be something you would be happy to see happen.
I'm glad that people see me as predictable.
It's not predictable. I just know this is right in your wheelhouse, yes. And this is the kind of thing that you talk about and advocate for on an ongoing basis.
Yeah. Well, what's been very interesting is over the past few years, there's been a very thoughtful, bipartisan dialogue around in using evidence and making decisions. And you would think, well, you know, that's pretty normal, isn't it? And not necessarily. But the fact that it's bipartisan, and it's also the House and the Senate, and this bill was introduced last session, toward the end of the session, by both Paul Ryan and Patty Murray, which is like polar opposites, mm-hmm. House and Senate and Democrat and Republican. But they both saw value in the legislation. And the bill is relatively innocuous. It creates a 15-member commission of experts in data and statistics. And the question is, should there be some sort of central data warehouse? I mean, we've got data.gov and stuff like that. But there have been what works clearinghouses created in different departments, such as in education, to look at what is it that works, and let's make sure that's where we invest our scarce dollars as opposed to things that may not work or nobody knows. But I think the key thing is, how do you wind up expanding the use of agency existing data, especially administrative data, to look at what works. There was a story the other morning on Federal News Radio that just struck me that is kind of an example of this. The Department of Transportation is trying to create a government or nationwide database or inventory of street addresses.
Mm-hmm.
That inventory already exists and created by the Census Bureau, and it was separately created and exists in the Postal Service. But by law, nobody can share this data. So you have another agency that's starting from scratch, going to build it. There may not be interfaces between the two. So there are all sorts of constraints, especially in social services programs for foster kids and abused kids and recidivism and stuff, where if they were able to integrate the data at the ground level with the child or the parents, we could do so much better in mm-hmm. terms of delivering services and cheaper and more effectively.
Tom Temin had that interview on the Federal Drive earlier this week, and I was happy to play it on my program too, because I agree with John, Alan. It's important, and I wonder if sometimes agencies talk about those kinds of things, anticipating that somebody might suggest what John has, which is, we have that already. Why can't we just give it to them and look at the reasons why that's not happening, rather than making them go through the process of doing it all themselves? It doesn't make any sense, I don't think.
No, it doesn't make sense, but three things struck me about this. First of all, strong support for outcomes and focusing on outcomes to be achieved rather than on inputs. And so, to its credit, the administration is already starting down that path a little bit. Why do we need a commission to do this? And why take 18 months to develop a plan, which will put us just at an interesting point in the calendar with this administration? But third, my experience, and I've only been in this business for 35 years, so I'm still learning it, is that outcomes and evidence-based information is rarely the primary decision point for why programs are started, why programs are executed, or how Congress funds them. And so this would be fabulous information. I'm sure we'll talk about Data Act and its implications. It also relates a little bit to John's earlier story on strategic analysis of programs from GAO report. I'm just not optimistic that even if this commission of experts were to come up with the right ideas, It'd have deep penetration in the agencies.
It's understandable. Your pessimism is understandable. I'm probably closer to John's optimism than you are, although I'm a little bit skeptical myself. I think tying it, though, John, to a government-wide inventory of programs first would make this evidence, whatever evidence and data that you're analyzing, exponentially more valuable on top of the value that you've already described that we can gain
but
from.
But that, again, assumes that you can figure out what a program is. Mm-hmm. Is your home mortgage deduction on your tax form a program? Is the EPA regulation for controlling the amount of CO2 coming out of smokestacks, is that a program? Is FAA's air traffic controller program, or is the runway incursion program within FAA a program? So there's no real easy way of defining it. So I think the waiting for a definition of program, and there is a law that's proposed to do that, I don't know whether that's the solution.
I wonder if that's even the right idea at this point, or is maybe a fair point. Yeah. So I'm just thinking on the fly. Is maybe the better option then trying to come up with an inventory of what we expect agencies to do, inventorying the outcomes rather than the programs, and maybe we find then that things are going on. There has to be a way to match, though, because then you want to make sure that if there are activities that agencies are undertaking that don't directly have to that have to do with those outcomes, then we don't want them anymore.
But see, that's why I flagged the other story, is that these strategic objectives are the first time a portfolio or a bucket of programs around an intended outcome. Mm-hmm. For example, access to healthy food. So I'm very encouraged by it. The other thing, though, that's different from my 35 years or so, is that over the past few years, there have been advocacy groups for evidence. I'm going like, I have never heard of such a thing. There's Results for America. There's Moneyball Government. They're getting set-asides put into appropriation bills. They're writing letters to the chief of staff of the president, and things are actually happening, and it's bipartisan. And then you have, like, the Arnold Foundation is pouring money into this kind of stuff, and that's very conservative. And then you have the Bloomberg Foundation pouring money to this for a local government. You have Pew. There's things that are – there's something that's happening that's very different, and that's why I think I'm much more optimistic than I have been in the past.
Is there a risk, though, that all of that momentum, because there's a lot of different people that are doing it and organizations and so on, is it possible that momentum could be slowed because of a diffuse exercise of energy rather than a bunch of coordinated effort going the same direction?
Well, I'm not seeing that yet. The people that are engaged are actually working together, and they're very respectful and stuff. But you have Pew is largely focused on states. Arnold seems to be more federal. Bloomberg more local. But it's all levels of government. It's not just somebody trying to do a program inventory of the federal government or something.
John Kaminsky's choice is the second most important federal news story of the week from GovExec. Bipartisan evidence-based policy bill passes House. It's Charlie Clark's story, and it's linked at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon. When we come back, the most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by Alan Schwatkin and John Kaminsky on this week's Federal News Countdown. Back on In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, the Federal News Countdown this week features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by Alan Schwatkin and by John Kaminsky, and we are up to
number one.
And John, your choice at number one is from Emily Kopp on federalnewsradio.com. Agencies plow ahead with Data Act despite big hurdles. And Emily writes, the executive branch has gotten Data Act off to a good start by meeting its first deadline, but persistent problems with the data itself threaten to undermine the financial transparency the law is intended to achieve. And that actually ties in with what we were just talking about on the number two stories, which is, what's the quality of the information that the administration and theoretically future administrations will ask the agencies to base their decisions on? If that's no good, then we've got big problems in fulfilling the vision of the Data Act, I think.
But what this law does is it, for the first time, creates some standardization across the government about reporting financial data. And it's something that you just are just, much like Alan was saying earlier, this is unfathomable that we're at this point in our country's history and we haven't done something like this. But it creates common identifiers for and unique identifiers for all grants and all contracts, and it follows the money from the agency down to the state or local government and then to the subgrantee level or subcontractor level, and provides a great deal of detail. And this was kind of inspired by the success of the Recovery Act.
Or the not-so-successful acts of the Recovery Act.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so this is sort of another try at doing something. And I think that commenting about the quality of the data now is a little premature because they've just begun to set the standards. And until they've got the standards in place and start coming up with a regular collection process, we really won't know about the quality. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that the earlier laws had that were not in their favor was that it was just seen as a compliance and reporting mechanism. Nobody was using it. And the idea here is how do you actually tie the spending data back to the budget data, back to the performance of programs? And so if the intent is to use the data, I think it's going to be cleaner, more naturally.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that I'm finding about this whole thing is that it's very technical and it could be implemented poorly and it would be a huge administrative burden. But if it's done right, and what GAO and everybody else is saying, they're implementing this smartly. And Dave Liebrich and Dave Mader are just superb leaders on this initiative. They're working well together. I just am very hopeful that this is going to work. But it doesn't get turned on until May of 2017.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the next president.
Yep. 3-4 months after the next president takes office. Now, we heard a lot about legacy IT in government because of the OPM breaches. I wonder when I look at this stuff if we might find at some point in the future, I'm certainly not hoping for it, but I wonder if we'll find that we have a legacy data problem where this standardization that John's talking about becomes a lot more daunting than it appears to be. Yeah,
Francis, you don't have to dig too deeply. I mean, look at the challenges agencies have of coming up with audited financial statements. So many of the financial systems are disconnected from the contracting systems, they're disconnected from the budget systems. So the Data Act is a great impetus for linking, touching all of those, bringing them all together. But there are big challenges ahead, and I compliment the leadership in OMB and the agencies and on the Hill who are continuing to draw the visibility and the support for it. But I don't think we should underestimate the degree of difficulty of getting to a good end result. I'm hopeful we are, just like you, just like John. We want to be there because you can't use good decision making if you don't have good data, where it's being used, how it's being used. But this is a significant challenge ahead.
Now, I don't know if you chose this story because you knew it pushed one of my buttons or not, but we've already covered this button earlier in the program. Emily writes in this story, John, the biggest hurdle the government faces may be the lack of a complete list of federal programs.
And I'm not sure that a list of the programs is a necessary underpinning. Some think so,
mm-hmm.
but I think that you can compute dollars and contracts and grants without having to define which program they're associated with. I think tying them back to strategic objectives mm-hmm. probably is a little easier.
So the outcomes inventory that we talked about earlier would potentially be as good a fit here.
I think that's a better platform to do that.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is that Congress sometimes has a bigger appetite than they're willing to pay for. And the Congressional Budget Office said this will cost about $300 million to implement. And according to Emily's article, the appropriators have only appropriated for four agencies about $25 million. So, you know, the executive branch agencies may be beat up of, we're not implementing this and all that. I don't know. The other thing is that there's three laws that have different definitions of what is a program. You have GPRA, you have the Data Act, and there's another bill that will most likely pass. It's called the Taxpayer Right to Know Act. And OMB, I think, is not doing an inventory until Congress decides which one of these definitions you're going to use. because they can't just get the agency spun up every couple years about, oh, well, then reclassify it this way.
Yeah, so, I guess
that. And I would add that the Budget Control Act, for purposes of appropriations and sequestration,
yeah,
and the funding levels,
right,
defines program, project, or activity, yeah, yeah, in a completely different way.
Yeah.
And so that's the misalignment, mm-hmm, between appropriations, programmatic, and contracting.
Yeah.
So this is a synchronization problem in Congress, then, as much as anything else, it sounds like.
And one of the challenges that the folks who are working this, we saw this in the Recovery Act. We saw a little bit from the president's so-called GATT board work, was to follow the money, because it starts with the money. If you can't follow the money, it doesn't matter what else you can do. And there were broken links all the way through this. Mm-hmm. It starts with definitions, but, you know, absent any other decision, it seems to me that the better one is, it's more difficult to change Congress than it is to change how the executive branch accounts for, mm-hmm, that.
Yeah.
Folks know how to do appropriations. We've been doing it for 200 years. I'll touch on that a little bit later.
Well, kind of. The last couple of years, kind of. The most important federal news story of the week is selected by John Kaminsky, is from federalnewsradio.com. It's Emily Kopp's story, Agencies Plow Ahead with Data Act Despite Hurdles. And you can find that and all of our stories on this week's countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon. The most important federal story of the week is selected by Alan Shvatkin, is next on Federal News Radio. Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. The Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by John Kaminsky and Alan Shvatkin. And Alan, we are up to number one on your list. It's from CQ. The headline is Appropriations Work Ends with a Budget Deal Still Distant. Tamar Hallerman, who's terrific and one of my favorite reporters on Capitol Hill, by the way, has this story on CQ's website. And this is a good news, bad news story, I think. The good news is in the first sentence. She writes, last week marked the first time in 6 years House and Senate appropriators completed committee-level work on all 12 of their spending bills. The bad news is it doesn't appear that there's any hope anytime soon of that actually translating into passed, signed budget bills that mean that at least some agencies can do something about it.
That's the concern. I mean, how many times have we talked on this program, and how many movies have we been to of just this same story, which is great progress, regular order, at least within the committees, to the credit of the chairman and the committees themselves, the subcommittees, to move their bills along. But they're all contentious. They become the real issue this year is a fundamental disagreement at the funding levels, the overall funding levels. President's budget that he submitted in February wants to substantially increase the amount of funding available for the federal agencies by almost $75 billion over what the current law and the Budget Control Act provides. The Republicans said, it's the current law, we're sticking with that. So bill after bill after bill has huge disconnects in the overall funding levels. Add on top of that policy riders. We're right now, we're going to be in the same place in the beginning and middle of September as we have been prior years.
The permutations, too, are starting to show up that we hadn't seen before. I had Mark Meadows on the program last week, the chairman of the Government Operations Subcommittee on OGR, and he brought up the possibility of an omnibus. Now, that's the first person that I've heard talk about omnibus. I'm not suggesting he invented the idea, but I just hadn't heard of it before he talked about it. But there's another kind of multiplier that can go into the mix here, John.
Well, the thing that doesn't seem to be in the media as much is that at about the time that the budget needs to be passed, we're going to breach the debt ceiling.
Mm.
And so that's going to become its own crisis. And oftentimes when you conflate the budget and having to raise the debt ceiling, weird things happen.
We're also, there's something, I don't know if it's something in the water or what's going on, because we seem to also go from one to another kind of external thing that doesn't have anything to do at all with the budget process, at least on the surface, and then shows it winds up impacting the budget process. It was the Confederate flag a couple of weeks ago.
Correct.
And it's Planned Parenthood now.
Yes.
Things that, I mean, topics I never expected would come up on this program ever in a million years are showing up all the time, it seems like.
And that's in part the strain, the segmentation among the congressional members. Some of that is pushed by constituents, and so I'm not at all surprised about that. But it's almost the challenge here is one of leadership, and on both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue, both on the Congress and the White House. I'm confident that in September we'll have some agreement that will carry over for a couple of weeks or a couple of months. But this is still no way to run a government. It's no way to run a Congress. It has enormous implications for the programs. You can't do strategic planning and budgeting if you've got several-week funding. You can't run an acquisition system on a shoestring if you only know week by week how much money do you have. You won't get the results you want if you're only tied to performance over a two-week period of time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, overhanging all of this, of course, is the P word, the politics of the environment. And so I'm hoping that the senior leaders in both the House and the Senate and the White House will get together early on and find a way out of it. There are outs. There are pressure relief valves that are available. Remains to be seen. I'm not asking anybody to blink, but I'm asking them all to come together for the good of the agencies, the good of the taxpayer.
We learned this week, John, that the comptroller at the Department of Defense had asked each of the branches to submit anomalies, it was what they mm-hmm. called them, that would be affected by sequestration. Is it possible, or would it be reasonable and or useful, do you think, for Congress to see a similar list of how continuing resolutions of varying lengths affect the agencies as far as their ability to deliver on mission?
Well, we
is that even quantifiable, I guess?
GAO did one after the last sequestration that listed out mm-hmm. programs and specific instances where money was wasted or opportunities were lost. The IBM Center did a report a few years ago that Phil Joyce, the University of Maryland, did for us. How do you manage under a sequestration? If you look back at the past 30 years, I think at least 25 of the past 30 years has had a continuing resolution.
Mm-hmm.
So it's become the norm as opposed to the exception, and there are techniques for managers to use. So that report, I think, is really helpful to people in terms of, well, if they're new to this, mm-hmm. As to some of the techniques that different agencies use.
Do you think that information is useful?
It is, and the two anomalies come up in two ways. One is in the Appropriations Committee, the agencies do this regularly through OMB. What do we have to take care of that's a one-time deal that would be affected by a continuing resolution? And then there are the programmatic anomalies. What are you going to stretch out? What will you not be able to execute in the event of a continuing resolution or something worse, which I won't mention?
Please don't.
That information is helpful, but I don't think the end game matters that much. It is still the respective hardline positions in both the executive branch and the Congress about these funding levels. A solution on that will open up the floodgates to lots of other solutions.
One other observation from this piece that Tamar did, and we have a link at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon, that she didn't write it in the words of the piece, but because of the juxtaposition of some of the names, it occurred to me. I remember, I guess it was three years ago, I think, when Senator Mikulski became at that time the chair of the Senate Appropriations mm-hmm. Committee. She was either second or third in line seniority-wise to become the chair of that committee. And she wound up getting it, no disrespect to her intended, but kind of by default because mm-hmm. the other people in front of her in line didn't want the job. Republicans have term limits in the House of Representatives for how long you can stay chair of a committee. But there have been times where they have asked, chairs have asked for and have received waivers for that. The chairman of the House Appropriations Committee, Hal Rogers, has expressed some frustration about this process and has already said he's not going to ask for a waiver to stay on top of that committee. It used to be that people would cut off body parts to become just members of the Appropriations Committee, let alone chairs of subcommittees and chairs of the full committee. And now it seems like they're jobs that are becoming a lot harder to fill, at least.
Right. It's a true statement. As Mr. Rogers has said, that the Appropriations Committee has lost some of the tools that they've had in the past to
earmarks.
Make the process work.
Earmarks is clearly really what it is, right?
Earmarks is a big portion of that. And also the claimants, the idea that the government should not be spending money on a longer list of topics, also a change.
It's a fascinating dance that we're going to unfortunately see last a lot longer than we'd hoped. Alan Shvatkin's choice is the most important federal news story of the week. Appropriations work ends with a budget deal still distant. And you can find that and all of our stories on this week's Federal News Countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon. Terrific countdown as always, gentlemen. Alan Shvatkin, thank you very much for coming in.
Always a pleasure.
My best to your colleagues at the Professional Services Council, John Kaminsky, IBM Center for the Business of Government. Same deal for you. Thank you for being
Thank
here today.
You. I appreciate the honor.
You can hear the entire program archived at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later today, and the Federal News Countdown returns next Friday on In Depth with Francis Rose.